Hi, everybody. My name is David Moore, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
Because the program works, I've been sober since August 24th, 1980, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And thank you for asking me to come talk. It's an honor and privilege to be here. It's taken, how long has this group been here? 5 years. It's taken 5 years to get over here, but here I am. And it really is. Y'all have an enthusiastic group, and I love going to meetings like this. I really do. It's just, you know you're in the right place when people are shaking hands and they look good and they're happy, and I just love it, and it's a real treat to be here. And it's good to see people. Chris H., I mean, I haven't seen him in years, and I was in the bathroom and he walked around the corner. I thought I was seeing a ghost, you know. Good to see you, and it's good to see all the people I haven't seen in so many years. I'm going to touch on some of the lowlights of my illustrious drinking career, and then hopefully I'm going to talk about, 23 years of sobriety, which is really what the news is about. If you don't know how to drink, then I don't know. I mean, you probably maybe need to try it some more. I had to drink until I reached a state called being ready to quit. I was in a state for a very long time called not being ready to quit drinking. I didn't know that's what it was. It was I went through a treatment center in March of 1980, and I just didn't identify. Another day, my sponsor grilled me on what we have here, this thing called identification, where the same thing that's wrong with me has to be the same thing that's wrong with you. I have to make that connection, or I'll tune you out, and I won't listen to what you're saying. And, in March of 1980, circumstances, I'll tell you what led to me getting up there. And the gentleman who heard me talk back in, how long ago was that? That was 8 weeks ago, back in Norman. Yeah, that's the last time I was able to speak. Let me get centered here. Okay, here's where we're going. I was adopted, and I was adopted out of a home for unwed mothers in Oklahoma City. And when I was 5 years old, or I'm sorry, 6 years old, my parents set me down and said, "We've got something to tell you." And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "You're adopted." And they did it exactly the way you're supposed to. They said, your natural mother wanted to give you a good home, and she couldn't provide for you, and she put you here where we could come pick you out, and you're special, and you're above average, because you got picked, and all these people love you. And I said, "Well, okay." And I didn't know how to act. They're like, "Well, how do you feel about that?" And I'm like, I don't know. And so I went through the list of all the people I could think of, all the kids in the neighborhood, and all the people I thought were my relatives. And no, none of them were adopted. I was trying to find somebody to identify with. Who else is adopted? If I'm adopted, there must be a lot of people. And the answer was nobody, except for my younger brother, who I'm not related to, but we came out of the same home. And he just came along a couple of years later. And then a few years after that, I got a sister out of the same orphanage, and none of us are related. My sister's got flaming red hair. I mean, we look a strange-looking family picture. We're all very different. But I remember after that, I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how I was supposed to react to that. And I went out and I sat on the front porch, and it was supper time, and I could see all the kids in the neighborhood playing. Everybody was out in the front yard, and their moms were calling them in for dinner. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about feeling different. I can tell you, sitting on that front porch there, 6 years old, I felt profoundly different. And one of the things that my parents had told me, I said, "Well, who was my natural mother?" And they said, "Well, we don't really know much about her." And they pulled out a little piece of paper that said, "Non-identifying information, mother or baby." And they started reading it off. It was what she was able to supply. And it said that she was had her age, and that she was from a musical family, and that she was, a large family. And it said that she was a bohemian. And my parents said, "Well, your mother was bohemian." And I said, "Well, what is that?" And they said, "Well, it means she was from a region of," she said she's from Czechoslovakia. And I said, "What is that?" I had no idea what that was. And I said, "Well, it's a country near Germany." And I went, "Oh, Germany," because I was watching Rat Patrol and Combat. So I knew what Germany was. And so I put my little mind to work on this. And I went to school the next day and told all the kids in my class that my parents had told me the night before that Adolf Hitler was my father. And a large crowd gathered, and it was, and I'm like, and, then the teacher came, and she said, "What's going on?" And I told him, and the teacher said, and I said, and she gave me a chance to back down, and I wouldn't. And so down to the principal's office I went, and the principal, he was a World War II vet, and he's like real upset at this, and he said, son, why are you saying that?" And I go, "Well, because it's true." And so they called my mother, and she came up there, and she got me in a room and said, "Why are you saying this?" And, you know, in my mind, I said, because you don't know, it could be true. You know, I was just trying to fill in the blanks. And she said, no, the math's not right. It doesn't work out. Adolf Hitler's not your father. And, you know, the only reason why I tell that story is I've thought about that a lot. And I've thought, how alcoholic, you know, I felt less than. Okay, and so I immediately go in the next day and I tell this grandiose, you know, story, which not thinking, you know, I'm going to get caught, you know, it's going to be seen through. And, you know, I was often to do that later on in my drinking. You know, I had the grandiose stories and then they go, but didn't you just say it? And I go, oh, you know, phew, exposed, you know, there I am. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm adopted. My parents, you know, I think sometimes people, just from my observation, people who adopt kids, oftentimes they try extra hard. You know, I know that my mother was insecure. She was always afraid she wasn't going to be good enough. And, you know, she actually had the fear that they were going to come back and say, you're not a good mother. And they were going to take all our kids away. You know, both my parents had their master's degree. My mother was a school teacher. When I came along, she quit school. By the time I got to the first grade, I knew how to read and write. You know, I mean, she just stayed at home and started teaching me, you know, from an early age. And they tried really, really hard. I have to say this also. When I got sober in 1980, there was it didn't really start then, but it was probably in 82 and 83. There was kind of a trend in Alcoholics Anonymous to blame your parents. You know, it was like you had to find somebody. We were all into being victims back then. And, you know, I have to tell you that I'm ashamed to admit it, but at the time I participated in that, and I blamed my parents, you know, and I held them responsible for what happened to me. Fortunately, later on, I got a good sponsor, and I did an inventory, and we were able to talk about that, and I make amends to my parents, you know, to this day for what went on. And I assure them over and over and over again that it was nothing that they did, you know. And my mother knows that beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, she says, yes, I know, but I still have to let her know that I know that she did the best she could, and I appreciate everything she did. The part about being adopted was interesting because later on I went back to Oklahoma and had the court records open and found my natural family. And it answered a lot of questions. It really did. It answered a lot of questions. The reason, you know, I was adopted into a family where there's no drinking, okay? And there are people like that. What that means is on the 4th of July, there's iced tea. At Christmas time, there's iced tea and coffee. Thanksgiving is iced tea. And every year at Thanksgiving, my grandfather would get the bottle of Mogan David out. It was the same bottle from year to year, as far as I can remember. He'd get the little aperitif glass and have two or three glasses of Mogan David. He's this Oklahoma farmer, you know, and he'd try and dance or sing a song, and they'd make fun of him all year long, and that was the extent of alcoholism in both sides of my adopted family. But I had this unnatural attraction to alcohol, and I couldn't understand it. My parents couldn't understand it, and I started drinking when I was 14 years old. And, you know, when you were 14, it was sometimes easier to get other things. You know, it was sometimes easier to buy outside issues than it was to get a six-pack of beer. And so I kind of played around with that until I was 19. I was married. My girlfriend had gotten pregnant. And, you know, this is not that uncommon. Got pregnant, and we got married. I got a good job. She got a good job. We had an apartment. We had two new cars. We had steaks every night if we wanted them. And all our friends were still living at home with their parents. And guess where the party was every night? You know, it was at Dave's house. Things got uncool. This was back at a time when if you were caught with, it's like a seed of marijuana, they were putting you away for 40 years in Huntsville. A friend of ours, another couple we knew, got arrested and the state took away their child. And we could easily see that happening in our case. And I remember I sat at home one night and I said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I came up with a plan, and the plan was that there were certain people we were going to cut out of our lives, some of these guys that didn't have responsibilities. And what we're going to do is we're going to drink. And this was like a brilliant thing. I mean, I was so excited at this. We're going to drink! You know, it's because it's like you don't go through life. You know, you got to have something to change the way you think and feel, okay? And since this is illegal and we're going to get in trouble, drinking was the answer. And I really believe it. You know, the alcoholism was waiting in the wings, you know, and it was like going, put the other stuff down, come on, you know, we got some drinking to do, you know, and it's like, come on, let's get serious. I remember I called my wife at work, and she's not an alcoholic, still isn't an alcoholic, and she was working nights, and I called her, and I told her about the brilliant revelation that I'd had, we're going to drink, and she's like, well, okay, you know, I mean, she didn't even know we had a problem, and So we got the old World War II warring blender out, and I went to the store and I bought the Coco Lopez and the stuff, and we're making Harvey Wallbangers, and we're trying finding other young couples to hang out with, and we're drinking, you know. And I really got into it. I you know, had the little wet bar that I was building. I never actually built it, but I stocked it for many years. I would always show her the plans, you know, and I'd say, I'm going to put this thing together. And then I would show her to the Thursday sports section where they advertised the half gallons, the discount half gallons. And I'd say, you know, this stuff isn't getting any cheaper. You know, I might as well run down and stock it now. And so, I mean, I did that, kept that charade up. And as soon as I started drinking, things started to happen quickly. If somebody would have grabbed me and they'd have said, David, you know, and just accused me of what I was doing, I think I would have knocked them down. Nobody ever accused me of what was going on. But I started doing stuff like I would take these half gallons and I would put them up high in the kitchen because my wife was short. And I rationalized, we've got a small child around. This is a lot of glass. It needs to be up here. Today I know that what I was doing was I was putting the bottles up high where she would be less likely to notice how quickly the levels were descending. I also discovered if you've got 8 bottles and you drink a little bit out of each one, you have 8 descending levels instead of one that goes down real fast. Okay, and so, you know, this is all, you know, clever thinking. And what I would do, last few years of my marriage, I would write the check out at my lunch hour, and I knew exactly what a half gallon of Kentucky Straight Bourbon whiskey at Red Coleman's cost to the penny. And sometimes I would get nervous, and I think that raised the rate, and I would call there and ask him if the price was still the same because I had to have the check written out beforehand because I didn't want the guy in the liquor store to see me write the check because my hand shook so bad. And it was important that they not see my hand shaking. I would rush over there on my lunch hour and buy the booze and put it in the trunk of my car so that I could race over and get my daughter from childcare so that I could beat my wife home so I could get the whiskey in the top shelf and run the empties down to my car. Okay? This is, you know, the third year of my marriage, okay? Things aren't going good. I don't have one of those glamorous, you know, car crash, you know, jumping over open drawbridge, you know, SWAT team stories. I mean, it's pretty much, I had this brown lazy boy. And we fought over that when, you know, I can't believe they wanted it. But when we got divorced, I took that lazy boy with me. And, you know, it was one of those things where you could hit it like that and the cloud of ashes would come up and it had kind of an aroma, kind of a cloud of its own that hung around it. That particular lazy boy was eventually burned. I would start drinking. It started off, I would have a drink after dinner. I mean, this is what, you know, adult people do, right? I mean, you come home, you have a drink after dinner. Then I found out you could drink with dinner. And then I found out you could drink before dinner. Who cares about dinner, you know? And I just kind of pushed the food around on my plate, and the wife is mad, you know. She went to all this trouble to cook. She never was an alcoholic, and I tried so hard to make her one. You know, I would buy these fancy dessert wines, and I'd go, how do you like this, you know? And I would bring stuff home, because she had to drink with me. That was the deal, you know, because how can I entertain if she's not going to keep up with me? And I would bring the stuff home, and she'd drink it, and she'd get sick, and then she wouldn't want to touch anything for a month. And so I had to resign myself to the fact that my wife was not going to be able to entertain with me. And it was kind of sad, but I was just going to trudge along as best I could. The marriage is not going so well because what I do is I start drinking, and I pass out in that lazy boy every single night. I come to about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I go into a very angry wife, you know, and, you know, it's not good, you know. And we met another couple and started hanging around with them. My wife thought she was having a mental breakdown, and I thought she was going crazy. She was having auditory hallucinations. That's what I called it. Because on Sunday morning, she would say, when are we going to do this, this, and this? And I go, we're not going to do that. And she'd go, yeah, last night you said that we could do this, this, and this. And I go, no, I never said that. And I'll tell you why I never said that. And so I would absolutely browbeat her and convince her that what she had heard that night had never happened. And she believed it for a while and thought she was having a mental breakdown. So we started touring psychiatrists so I could find out what was wrong with her. I called my old psychology professor in college and said, my wife's having auditory hallucinations. She hears things. And y'all know what was happening. As I was drunk, I was saying things and then getting up the next day and not remembering it and just convincing her that it had never happened. We went to one psychiatrist, And I went in because I'd had 6 months of psych, so I was going to go in and I was going to help assist in her treatment plan. And, you know, we sat down and he goes, well, why are you here? And I said, we're here because of her. And she starts talking. I cut her off and I explain what's wrong with her. And he goes, oh. And he asks her a question and I fill in the blank. And then, you know, finally he whips around in the chair and he talks to me for the rest of the hour. And he starts asking me questions about my drinking, which is something we don't ever talk about. And I keep looking at her like, you know, what's wrong with this guy? You know, I'm keep making eye things like, what's going on here? You know, and we leave and I say, what was wrong with him? You'd think there was something wrong with me from the way he was talking. And she goes, I don't know. I said, well, we're never going back there. That's it. Through with him. We finally found a guy that would play our game. He charged a whole lot more than anybody else. He actually sat there and let me explain what was wrong. He said, oh, that's very interesting. And he asked me to leave the room. No, I could understand that. My wife left with a great big paper sack full of physician samples of all kinds of drugs, you know. And she says, well, I should try some of these. And I said, what you got there? You know, I don't think she ever took a single one of those. I took all of them. I remember thinking, well, she's shorter than me. She's got to take care of the baby. I'll take this, and since I'm bigger than her, you know, I can advise her on the effects, so she'll know how much to take. And, you know, I mean, just had all this stuff worked out in my head. She asked what happened to them, and I said, they fell down the sink and got wet, and I threw them all away or something like that. You know, I mean, I just, you know. Anyway, we met this other couple. They said, you know, you're not crazy. Your husband's an alcoholic. And she went, oh, I mean, she loved the idea. She took to it. I mean, she really jumped on that. And then my little show was about to come to an end. She came in and said, I love you. I always have, and I probably always will, but my daughter and I deserve better than to sit here and watch you kill yourself. And we're leaving. She was gone, and that was it. And it happened so quick. I'm like going, what? And all of a sudden, I'm divorced. I got my little, you know, in my head, I'm like, okay, fine. You know, this doesn't bother me. I got married way too young. I got the single life. Greenville Avenue was popping and going crazy. I need to be down there, hang out my single shingle. You know, Dave's in town ready for business. So I got this nasty little apartment, little efficiency, charming little place. And I set out to enjoy the good life. And you know, with nobody to have any pretext, no promises, nobody asking, you know, my friends at this point are gone. Okay. I mean, I'm talking about the guys I grew up with, the guys from elementary school, the guys who hung in there. The ones, and I remember one of them, you know, I remember going to his wife's birthday party. I remember walking in the door. I remember everybody laughing, and that's it. I don't remember anything else. It's the next morning, and it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm just coming around, and the phone's ringing, and it's him. And this is just kind of a little example. You know, I go, hello, and he says, you son of a bitch. And I'm like, you know, and I'm stalling, you know. He goes, why did you do that? And I'm like, you know, because I don't know. I don't remember anything. Yet, you know, if you tell people you can't remember, you're crazy, right? You're crazy. And I obviously did something big because he's not joking. I know him, and there's no happiness in his voice. And he says, my wife cried for an hour after you left. Why did you do that? And I'm stalling, and I'm hoping that he'll give me some information so something will come back to me. And I go, well, you know. And he goes, no, I don't know. And he said, Dave, listen. He said, you can't come over anymore. Okay, sorry. Click. You know, and it just went like that. Boom, 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 boom. They're all gone. You know, there's nobody left. Mom and dad, you know, my mother, up until the very end, was good for $20 out the back door. You know, dad said, son, we can't help you anymore. You know, we just can't help you anymore. I'm trying to hang on. I'm one of those guys that I got up every morning and I went to work. Okay, no matter what, I made it to work, you know, because by God, that's my source of whiskey. You know, that's my whiskey money. I will keep my job no matter what. Under all conditions, I will get to work. But, you know, I would spend, you know, I get paid on Friday, and, you know, Monday, I'm flat broke, you know, and I'd call, you know, Mom, they slashed my tires, you know, it's like, and I bought new ones, but I don't have any more money. Well, okay, I'll give you $20, but don't tell your father, come to the back door. You know, and we talk about enabling, but you know what? My mother kept me alive, you know, and I accused her of being an enabler, and now I thank her for keeping me alive. You know, I really do. And I also thank my father for cutting me off and being harsh with me. okay, because he was the other side of the coin. There's nobody left. I don't know. I got so many stories of degradation, you know, that just kind of just like that. You know, the longer I'm sober, the drunker I was. You know, it's like when I first got here, you know, I sat in the back and I think maybe I don't belong here. You know, I kept waiting for somebody to come in and go, "Oh, David Moore, you made a mistake. Oh, we're sorry. You don't belong here. You're not really an alcoholic." But, you know, the more I sat and the more I listened, you know, it's like the more I identified, you know, I'd think, here's somebody say, you know, let me say this. This is so important. When I was in that treatment center, they took us to meetings. They brought meetings to us. You know who I met in the treatment center? Chuck C. Okay, he came and talked to us. The lady that ran that treatment center, Mary Lib Mueller, or she was the AA coordinator. He was in town. She had him come talk to us. I thought, who is this old geezer? You know, tuned him out. And I think about that now, and I thought, man, I wish I'd have known who he was, all the questions I could have asked. I would sit in meetings, and this voice ran in my head. And I didn't know the voice was there until it quit. And the voice was this: "I'm not like that. I didn't do that. See, that never happened to me. I can't be like that." And it went, and it was a desperate voice, but it was just underneath the surface. It was the voice that said, "I don't really belong here. I thought y'all were nice people. My God, you were like, it was like church. And I thought that once I got my life together and once I straightened out my real world problems, I might come back and visit you on a Sunday. You know, we might go have pie like you talked about, but Lord, I had problems and I could not see that what you offered had anything to do with what was going on with me. I mean, I was facing jail for non-payment of child support. My attorney wouldn't return my phone calls. I mean, I had piles of problems. And what you had to offer, I couldn't relate. I could not relate." I got out of the treatment center, goofed around. And, you know, a couple of days later, I'm, you know, devising the experiment to prove that I am powerful over alcohol, you know, which was buy a pint of something you don't like, use the jigger. It was the only time I ever used a jigger. Use a jigger, have two drinks, and then check your face in the mirror to see if you're growing fangs. You know, see any signs of werewolf, you know, or anything like that. Look, I'm okay. You know, that was so successful. I obsessed on my experiment all the next day. Finished that pint that night, and the very next day I was buying half gallons. Okay, so, I mean, there I was. Right out of the treatment center. Now I'm having to hide it. Now I'm having to lie because everybody thinks I'm sober. And they're patting me on the back, and I'm going to great lengths to hide my drinking now. I'm like... And one time I rationalized, you know, this is at the desperate end where what I'm doing is I am desperately trying to prove that what I heard in the treatment center and what I heard in AA meetings did not apply to me and it wasn't true. Because see, this is also so very important. What y'all gave me, and you said it with a clear eye and you said it with a strong voice and you wanted nothing from me, you told me the truth. And the truth, you know, even though I say I wasn't listening, the truth, powerful. You know, the big book says we can offer the truth. Okay, because we have a solution. The truth is cold. The truth is hard. The truth is if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, then chances are you will die a lonely, hard disease from the death of alcoholism, and it's going to be ugly. And nobody, if you're an alcoholic, nobody does an end around and outwits and outsmarts the disease. Okay, it's a fact. You win the lottery, you don't go to AA and get a handle on it, you're going to die drunk. Okay, you find the right woman, you get the right job, you get the right car, you get the right house, all these things, you get it. You know what? You're going to die drunk if something doesn't happen. It's not, and I was always trying to find just those things that were going to make it right. You know, it's this. I'm lonely. I need to find the right person. You know, I need a better job. I need this. I need that. You know, it's like all these things. And in AA, you just very calmly told me the truth, and you didn't want anything from me, and you didn't have an angle. It drove me crazy. I couldn't figure out what your angle was. You know, I'd never been. People like I met in AA were not a part of my world. Okay, I didn't know how to relate to people who wanted nothing from me, who looked at me and only wanted to be helpful. And I say I didn't listen, and yes, I was desperately pushing what you said away as fast as I could, but I believe it was the truth, and it went in and it stayed in there. Because I can tell you, I remember laying on the floor of my apartment, having fallen out of the Lazy Boy. You know, I'm so grateful they made an apartment with a carpet that didn't burn. The cigarette fell out of my hand every night. The drink spilled in my lap. I would come to about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I was obsessed. Did I wet myself, or did I spill my drink? You know, that for some reason, that bothered me. Oh, I had to know which one it was. I'd go, because it's cold now, but it's been a long time, so maybe, and I never knew. It drove me crazy, because the chair had an aroma of its own. But I can remember getting drunk, falling on the floor, had my apartment caught fire, I couldn't move a single muscle. I mean, I was paralyzed, drunk, couldn't move, and this was wide awake and racing a million miles an hour, arguing that I'm not like the people in AA. What they said can't apply to me. You know, God, that's a horrible way to live. You know, it does mess up your drinking. You know, it really does. And I went through all kinds of machinations. You know, okay, well, I've got to get a week sober so I can come back. So if you ask where I've been, I'll just tell I was going somewhere else. But I couldn't get a week. You know, it's like when I tried to quit smoking many years later, the thought of not smoking made me nervous and I smoked more. You know, and it's like the thought of not drinking made me thirsty and I drank a whole lot more. Thoughts of like trying to get a week together to come back to AA, and I'm just like, oh, I can't do it. So I'm drinking. I finally cried out in sincere despair, God help me, one night, one Sunday evening, you know, all by myself. Nobody was calling me, you know. Nobody was looking for me. Nobody wanted my company. You know, and yes, jail trips. Yes, broken arms. Yes, falling down flights of stairs. Yes, wrecked cars. Yes, I mean, all the stuff, you know. I mean, coming to work, you know, cast all busted up. People did not look at me and said, well, what did you do this week? And they're like, oh, God, don't look at him. Don't talk to him. You know, I'd walk in a room, people go, You know, I mean, I was a sad figure, you know. I was 25 years old, okay. I cried out in sincere despair, you know, God help me. And 1 week later, I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was August 24th, 1980. And I have not found it necessary to take a drink since. Now, I was 26 years old, and you know what happened was, I hit that bottom. I thought everything was lost, and I remember this. I was going to call a lady that morning that I knew in AA, and I found the big book that gave me in treatment, and I started reading the stories in the back, because I couldn't read that stuff in the front. It was mind-bending. I could not handle it, but I could identify with the stories. Well, I couldn't until that Sunday morning, waiting to call her to let her know that I was ready to come back. And I remember reading the story about the officer in the Indian Army. And I'm going, yeah. And the lady who lost her laundry. I had laundry problems when I drank, too. I had a dryer that didn't have a timer on it. So when you put your clothes in, you had to mentally note. Okay, and it only had one setting, and that was, you know, like hell's furnace. You know, it was like hot, and you had to go in and catch it. Well, you know, I put my clothes in and then pass out. You know, I had laundry problems. I could relate. So I'm like reading all these stories and I'm going, yes, yes. And my excitement started to build. You know, it was just, I started getting excited and I couldn't explain it, you know, and I couldn't have sat down and analyzed it or talked about it. I just, you know, it's like I started to get what was hope. Okay. The tiny, tiny thing. And my hope was so fragile. And my hope started off as like, maybe what happened to you can happen to me. And I was one of those guys, I sat in the back, I didn't get chips until I had 9 months sober, because I thought that, you know, the group I got sober at, big deal on chips, you know, and somebody actually wrote my name on the board, and I was, and they said, David M. for 3 months, and I'm like, who's that? You know, I'm like looking around, you know, I wouldn't get the chips. So he said, isn't that you? I go, no, that's not me, it must be another David M. Because I thought getting a chip meant that I was promising the group that I was going to stay sober and come back and get the next chip. And I was so convinced that I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't make that promise. I was tired of promising people I was going to do right, you know. My daughter, I can remember her calling. My daughter loves me. You know, she loved me then. She loves me now. I can remember promising to do something with her on a Saturday. And this happened many times. And, you know, I had every intention of getting up that Saturday and going over and picking her up, and we were going to do whatever it was. But, you know, it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, and I've misjudged, and I'm laying on the floor, and I can't move, you know, and the phone's ringing, and the phone rings, and the phone rings, and I still can't get up to answer it because I can't move because I'm too drunk, and the phone rings, and the phone rings. And when I finally talked to my mother, she said, you know, your daughter probably called your house 200 times, and she'd let it ring, and she'd say, Micah, he's not going to answer. No, I know he's going to. I know he's going to. And my mother would tell me that. I'm like, God, you know, man, I couldn't live with myself. You know, it was just one thing after that, over and over. How could I promise y'all I'm going to stay sober? I can't stay sober. An old timer came up to me and said, son, I got good news and bad news. I said, what's that? And he says, the bad news is you can't stay sober. Oh, my God. God, how do they know? they know. You know, there I was, you know, I'm thinking they're going to throw me out because I don't belong here. And then I'm thinking they're going to throw me out because they know I can't make it. And he said, the good news is we can. And I tried to grab hold of that. We can stay sober. I can't stay sober by myself, but we can stay sober. I got a sponsor, finally. Pushed that till the very last minute. You know, I will drink tonight or get a sponsor, you know. I'd played the who's going to be my sponsor. I had the guy all picked out. He's still sober today, but this was 1980, right? So his shirt was open down here, gold chains, and in his own words, baby blue Mercedes to match his eyes. Okay, when he walked in the room, his beautiful girlfriend, he walks in the room, everybody knows him, he's real wealthy. You know, he starts telling jokes. I think, that's the guy who's got what I want. You know, so the night I'm going to ask him, he gets his 30-day chip. How can that be? You know, I mean, he's a winner, right? And I realized I didn't know squat about anything. I got my sponsor. Okay, here's what happened. They knew me. This is embarrassing. They knew the sound of my voice at the credit union. Because I would call down there and say, can I borrow some money? No, Dave, you're maxed out. Oh, how do you know it's me? Okay, so I'll call different branches and they know who I was. And I called and they changed the requirements and they said, well, just a minute. They said, yes, the limit's been raised. You can borrow. And I was able to get enough money to pay off my attorney, pay my rent, pay my child support, not go to jail. I had a big whopping check. They said, would you like it? I'll be there at 5:15. Boom, I drive straight over there. Okay, I've got about 60 days sobriety, something like that. I pick up the check. And I drive out of there, and I'm just ecstatic. My problems are over. I go to a red light. I mean, it's a stop sign. Go left 2 blocks. I'm at the Alpha Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I got sober. Straight forward 2 blocks. I'm at Red Coleman's in Addison. Little voice pops into my head. Simple voice. Very simple. And just said, where are you going? That's all. Where are you going? And I answered it. I said, I'm going to the liquor store. I'm going to get money orders to pay all these people off. And I'm going to buy a trunk load of half gallons. And I'm going to go home and celebrate. It was honest. That's what I was going to do. And then I said, God help me. And I took a left. And I went to a 6 o'clock meeting at the Alpha Group, which I had never been to before. I didn't recognize any of the people there. The guy sitting at the table chairing the meeting, I'd never seen him before that I knew of. But I'm sitting there with this big check in my pocket. The meeting's over at 7. Liquor store's open till 9. I'm sweating bullets. If something doesn't happen, I'm not going to make it. And I'm watching this guy, and he's laughing, and he's happy, and he's relaxed. He is happy, joyous, and free, all of the things that I'm not. And I don't know who he is, but I walk up to him and say, hi, my name's David, and I got this big check in my pocket, and I'm about to go, will you be my sponsor? And he said, well, let's go talk. And he set me down, and he said, I can be your sponsor if you can agree to this statement. If you can agree to this, I can help you. If you can't agree to this, neither I nor anybody else can help you. And I said, what's that? And he said that you are your mother's son, that you have given life your best shot, and that your best attempt at living life your way is that you're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're telling me that you're an alcoholic and that you cannot do it without our help and that you need us. Can you agree to that? And, you know, this man got through to me, you know, and I went, yeah, yeah. And he said, good, let's get started. What a great guy. He had a 6th grade education. He didn't have a telephone. He said, that's okay. I'm here every day at 12, 6, and 8. And he was. You know, and he took me through the steps, and he heard my first inventory. You know, and God was there. God was in that relationship. I wrote my inventory out, and when I went to go knock on the door, he was coming to the door, and I thought, oh, my God, what have I got here? I can't tell him this. And then I did this instant edit in my head. I thought about running, but I couldn't get down the steps before he came to the door. So I'm going, oh, my God. And I did this. Okay, I'll tell him that. No, I can't tell him that. Okay, all right, get ready. Go in, sit down. We'll go in his room, get on our knees, say the prayer. He gets up. And I get ready to say the big lie, okay? And I open the book up, and I go, and his hand reaches out, and he takes that from me. He goes, let's see what you got. And my first thought is hit him, jump out the window. And then it's like, God is doing for me what I can't do for myself. I don't think I thought it in those terms, but I knew that I couldn't get away, and my sponsor read my inventory to me. And I surrendered, you know? I mean, it's like, I'd like to say that, yes, I had courage galore, and I had all this stuff, and I didn't. You know, when it came right down to it, I was scared to death, and I couldn't tell him that stuff, and he read it to me, you know. That man got drunk, and he died. And somebody many years later said, hey, my mom dated him for a while, and they had his sobriety chip with his, it was a different kind of chip, but it had his name on it. And his original sobriety date, and they gave it to me. and I keep it at home. You know, this is a powerful disease, very, very powerful disease. And it's almost the strongest thing that I've ever encountered in my entire life. And the only thing that I've encountered that's a little bit stronger is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's real important that I say this tonight because, yes, the program of AA is more powerful than the disease of alcoholism. But you got to understand, you know, it says in our book, it says, of those who came and really tried, 50% got sober at once. So a lot of us sitting there going, oh, I got a 50-50 chance. No, you don't. If you come in here and really try, what does that mean, really try? Does that mean that you do everything your sponsor says, that you show up and do everything? If you really try, you got a 50-50 chance? That's what it means, of those who came and really tried. And in sobriety, I have something big happen, and I go, oh, my God. You know, well, I'm glad that all the big stuff is over, and then a couple of years later, you know, it's like, ah, you know, it's like more, there's more. And, you know, sometimes the first big crisis I had in my sobriety, I was talking to my sponsor, Jim, and, you know, I think it's natural for a whiner like me to ask why. And the thing that we came up with, I said, does this sound good? And he said, yeah. I said, you know, I'm going through this for no other reason than to show that you can stay sober no matter what. And I'm just going to be an example of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened on that first go-round was I was single and sober for 9 years and met this lady who, she was a low-bottom drunk. And I knew it too. She said that when you go buy a car, you always look in the back seat because you know you're going to be living in it one day. I went, oh, yeah, you know, you're a low bottom. Beautiful lady. She was from England. She had come over here and, you know, had a real alcoholic story and had become a paralegal and was very successful. And we got married. And, had to work it around her, you know, jail meetings. I was real resentful because we kept having to change everything around the meetings she took down to the women's jail. And then there was a real spiritual experience one night, and I saw her daughter, and her daughter was running the streets crazy. And I was able to sit down, and I talked to her daughter, and boom, all of a sudden her daughter's sober and going to meetings. And we had the happy AA little nucleus there. You know, I introduced her to her birthday. She introduced me at my birthday. Everything was great. After a couple of years, things started to fall apart. My wife's sponsor moved away. She didn't get a new one. She took on some extra responsibilities at work, some school, trying to get some extra accreditation. She's not going to meetings. Things are starting to fall apart. I'm on the phone to my sponsor, and I'm talking about her, and he says, it's none of your business. I said, none of your business. You know, it's up to her. You know, how many guys are you sponsoring? What are you doing? Okay, fine. All right, you just keep doing what you're doing, and what happens to her is none of your business. You stay out of it. So I'm doing that. You know, and all the advice he gave me works. It really does work. And but she's unhappy, and she's miserable, and she doesn't want to go to meetings, and she doesn't want me to go. And I say, come with me, but then she's not ready on time. My sponsor says, well, you will leave. And I said, oh, boy, there's going to be some fireworks. And he says, you will go. And so I do, and there's fireworks. And, you know, things are tense at home, and I'm hanging on, you know, because I'm doing what I'm supposed to. I'm sponsoring a bunch of guys. I've got my committed meetings. I got brought into this type of AA when I had about 5 years of sobriety, and I have to tell you, this type of AA saved my life. I could talk about this for a long time, but let me say that I was doing AA. I was doing everything that I'd ever been told to do in AA, and I had this like thing in the back of my head that said, what I'm doing is good, but I know it's not going to make it for the long haul. And I didn't know how to explain that. I didn't know how to express it because, like, you know, I'm doing everything I possibly can. You know, I'm ashtrays, trash cans, sponsor people, any commitment, yes, and yet something was missing, and I didn't know how to verbalize it, but I just knew I wasn't going to make it for the long haul. How do you explain that to people when you're doing more than anybody around you? And then I met this guy who was my sponsor for many years, Jim Shaw, okay, an Okie, okay, and I came here and I watched him go through all kinds of trials and tribulations, and I said, how does a man with that much sobriety stay sober? You know, with all the stuff that's going on, and that was attractive. His trauma and his rough life was attractive because he was staying sober. That's what attracted me to him. And he brought me into this kind of AA, you know, the committed meetings. This, you know, it's like we don't just say it, we really mean it. you know, and he backed it up with action. And I'd never really been, you know, I'd say that up to that point, I talked a good game, but if it was inconvenient, we didn't do it, you know. And he taught me, no, that's not what we do, you know. And I was just impressed with the man and the character and how he held up under the things that were going on. That's a whole hour in itself. But so he brought me to that type of AA, and that's what I was doing, and I've been doing it for many years, you know, probably not the best, but as best as I could do. And it was, I could feel it. I was doing good. What happened, things just deteriorated at home. It was just crazy. I was okay, but she was crazy. And then I found out that what was going on was she was having an affair with a guy I sponsored. And, oh, my God, it was like somebody threw a hand grenade into that group. You know, I mean, it was like, boom, you know. And it was one of those deals where everybody knew but me, you know. And it's like people were coming up to me saying, I thought, cryptic things. And they go, how are you? And I go, I tell them. They go, how's Christina? And I go, yeah. And they go, well, and they tell me something because they knew and I didn't know. And I go, what are you talking about? I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I cared for my wife. I loved her and I wanted her to be okay. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I found out. And, you know, I called her. You know, I mean, and we separated. And, you know, it was, there had been so much lying, so much deceit, so much damage. And, I didn't know if she was, you know, stay sober. I didn't know if this guy was going to be able to stay sober. And I remember I called him. See, because if you're my worst enemy in the world, if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't wish getting drunk on you. And I remember calling her saying, you know what? You don't have to get drunk. Somebody had given me the tape of a guy in Las Vegas, Susan Bray, called me on the phone, said, you need to listen to this tape. The same thing happened to this guy. And I listened to it, and everybody stayed sober. And I called her, and I said, you know what? We can all stay sober. I said, we can even meet in a few years and laugh about this, you know. And but, you know, she couldn't do it, and she went back out. And this kid went back out. I, you know, things went bad for me. I mean, you know, heck, I went crazy, you know. I mean, at work, they said, you know what, we really don't want you driving our company trucks. Why don't you take a little time off? So here I am with 12 years of sobriety at home on mental disability. Oh boy. And you know what? People were coming out to, will you be my sponsor? I was inundated with people. And actually, they came right before it started. So much so that I called my sponsor on the phone. I said, something bad's about to happen to me. He goes, why do you say that? I said, because I have never had this many people, selfish guys, just crazy, ask me to sponsor them. Something bad's about to happen. He goes, oh, you don't know that. Stop it. But that is exactly what happened. And you know what? Sundays were bad during that time. Man, Sundays were bad. And I can't tell you how many inventories I heard on Sundays. You know, how many fifth steps I heard. How much time I spent with those guys. And you know, when all this started, I thought that I was going to plunge off the deep end. And I was going to be one of those old timers. Oh, yeah, Dave's been sober a long time, but he's a little crazy. You know, don't talk to him. You know, just talk to somebody over here. I thought I was going to be one of those guys, you know, crazy Dave, you know, brain gone, still not drinking, but, you know, not really there. I called my sponsor on the phone, you know, and you know what? He wouldn't let me call him five times a week like I wanted to. I called him once, you know, I didn't call him my regular time on what was it, Thursday night. And he said, David Moore, what problem have you got now that is so important that you have to call me before your time? I'm like, sorry, you know, and it really, I just wanted to whine, you know, and when he would call me, we'd get on the phone and my God, I had lots of stuff going on. And I'm going to talk quick. Here's what happened. This all hit at the same time. Okay? My first wife sued me in the middle of this. I got served with papers. She wanted a ton of money. My daughter was about to turn 18. I went with my briefcase to my attorney, you know, because I had an attorney and I was, you know, I'm getting sued briefcase. And I went in and I said, look what I got. And he goes, He goes, oh, she's going to get about $20,000. I don't have $20,000. Well, she's going to get it. I said, you don't understand. I don't have $20,000. He says, you don't understand. She's going to get $20,000. And I'm like, oh, my God. And my parents don't even know my wife has left. My brother has got end-stage liver disease and is 4-point restraints in Baylor waiting for a liver transplant. He's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. His liver failed in sobriety. He's over there. They're taking turns sitting with him, so hopefully he won't be in restraints because, you know, he's just out of his head. And when I go see my parents, they're over there crying. My sister-in-law got fired from her job because they didn't want to pay for a liver transplant, and the pressure got to her, and she got put in an institution. And my parents have got my brother's two little kids, and when I go see them, they're just crying. They're going, we're too young to raise these little girls. And I look at, or too old, and I said, yes, listen, I don't know how, but if I have to, I'll raise my nieces. This all happened at once, guys, like 20 days. All this came down. Here's the message. If I had needed a good program, if I had had to go get a good program, you'd have a different speaker tonight, okay? I had to have a well-running machine, finely tuned, in place, and that's what I had, and it carried me through that time. It was amazing. I look back over that, and by God, I was carried. Not by angels, but I was carried by the principles and the steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I would call my sponsor, he would go, okay, Dave, you've got 2 minutes, go. And in that 2 minutes, I got to tell him what was going on. Well, I'm going to lose a lake house. I get to keep my car. You know, he says I'll probably have to file bankruptcy because I have to take all the bills. You know, by the way, my wife was a paralegal. Don't, you know, if you're married to a paralegal, don't divorce her because, oh, my God, it was just tied me up in court like you wouldn't believe. And she may have been drinking, but, she and her buddies could file suits. And I tell my attorney, this is not fair. He goes, it's not. I'm getting screwed. You are. And I go, well, it's not right. He goes, no, it's not. And he said, but Dave, you don't have any problems money won't solve. I go, what's that supposed to mean? He goes, Dave, you're sober. He was a sober attorney. And he just said, you know, it's unfortunate, but you're going to lose. But you're young. You can get it all back. I called my sponsor, and I got to tell him about that for 2 minutes. And then he would go, time is up. Dave, tell me about the people you're sponsoring. Start at the top. Tell me their name and what step they're working on. Let's go through them all. And that was what I got to talk about for the rest of the time because he knew that, you know, I'm glad my sponsor never said, Dave, I want you to go home and get in touch with your feelings, okay? Because I lived right over here, you know, and I lived right across the street from Lawler Park. And my feelings were to crawl to the top with my hunting rifle and get my name in the paper and take a bunch of you with me. That was my feelings, okay? I was insane. Don't get in touch with your feelings. He said, Dave, tell me about the guys you sponsor and what they're doing and what you're doing. That's all I got to talk about. Okay? And I thought I was going to be at least crazy for 5 years, you know? And about a year later, you know, the divorce is over, and I had committed her to an institution that day. I'm at a step study out at Joe Gray's Lake House. My sponsor pulling him from California. I'm sitting beside him on a swing, and I'm realizing I'm going to be okay. They called me out there and said she escaped from the nut house. My sponsor said, you've done all you can. Let her go. Oh, my God. I thought that was the biggest thing that happened to me. And then a year ago, they came up to me at work. I recovered from that. You know, they forgot about it. You know, got promoted. Good job. Doing all kinds of stuff. They came in and said, oh, gosh, your job title's been eliminated. You know, you've got 60 days to find another job within the corporation or you're out of here. Sorry, you know, no benefits. Bye. And, oh, my God, my wife and I, we're going to lose everything. You know, and program taught me to get off my butt and start going. I went and applied, found a job, same corporation, different company. All my benefits transferred. Whew, whew. Okay, I mean, that was devastating, okay, to think I was going to lose all that. And it's like God's going to take care of me no matter what. It's going to be okay. Get off your butt and go. And it was. And then I started feeling bad. I couldn't tell what was wrong with me. You know, I'm going to the doctor. It's like, man, I'm tired all the time. Yeah, I lose some weight, fat boy. Well, okay, that's not it. You know, so I go to another doctor, you know, and finally in August I go to a doctor. And he says, well, let's do some x-rays. You know, and he calls me back and says, you need to come back for another x-ray. Okay, so I go back. And then he calls me back and he says, you need to come in. And the nurse says, you need to come in and discuss your x-rays. What's wrong? You need to come in and discuss your x-rays. So we go in. And he says, I'm not going to joke around. He says, there's something not right in your x-rays. And that afternoon, I'm a CT scan. A couple of weeks later, I'm in a surgeon's office, and they're cutting me open, and they're going in, and they're doing biopsies. And then he won't give me the results, and he calls me, and he says, it's not good. You need to go over to the cancer center. I've made a referral. And I get in there, and the guy says, you've got lung cancer. Did you know that you only have one lung? Your right lung's completely closed. You've got a softball-sized tumor, and it's spread, and it's in your trachea, and it's in your esophagus. And my wife and I just, I thought I had a little spot or something, you know? And this is bad. And then he gives me the odds. He says, people who've got what you've got, he said, you make it, there's a 30% chance, 20, 30% chance you'll be alive in 3 years, and there's a 10 to 15% chance you'll, in 3 years, and then there's a 10 to 15% chance you'll be alive in 5 years. And I said, well, but I haven't smoked in 12 years, and I don't drink. He goes, it doesn't matter. You know, he says, this is the kind of cancer that gives cancer a bad name. And my wife and I, you know what? It was like somebody pulled a dark shroud over us. We both plunged into this depression. And it's like, and the doctor says, well, you know, they offered to give me something for depression, you know. And it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I called my sponsor. And, you know, he reminded me of something that Shaw told me once. You know, big loads for big hosses, little loads for little hosses. You know, something Norm Alpa used to tell my sponsor. And, you know, my wife went and got me that book, Chicken Soup for the Surviving Soul, 101 Stories of People Who Have Survived Cancer. And you know what? I read those stories, and it was like reading the stories in the back of the big book. And I got hope because I identified. Because you know what? Just because they say that doesn't mean you're going to die. My sponsor said, you know, David, the odds are there, but you know what? That doesn't mean anything. People survive. So they started me on this double barrel program of chemo and radiation. They said, well, you're young, you're going to get the full shot. And they told me they were going for a cure, but they also told me it was going to be devastating. And it was horrible. When I was in Norman, I barely was able to talk, and I had to cancel all the chemo, just kicked my butt in the radiation. All my armpit hair fell out 3 weeks ago. That was bizarre. But And I won't go into the details. It was really rough. It was really rough. And I got a three-week break, and this Monday I was supposed to start a new chemo drug again. And I went in, and he says, well, you know, you still haven't recovered. Your white blood cell count's too low. He said, let's do a chest x-ray. And, you know, and I'm praying. And you know what? God put tons of people in my life to sponsor. You know what? I'm sitting there on chemo. I can't get up, but the phone rings all day long. And, you know, I talk as best I can to these guys, you know, and they said, thanks, that helps me a lot. You know, I hang up the phone and I pass back out, you know, and I'm so sick, you know, and I'm puking and all this kind of stuff. And the doctor comes in and he says, I don't want you to get all giddy. He said, but there's no sign of cancer on your x-ray. You know, he says, it's gone. And we want to dance, and he goes, no. He says, no, be cool. This is just a simple x-ray. You know, it's not a CT scan. It's not a PET scan. And he said, besides, you're going to start this chemo, and, mister, you're losing your hair. He said, nobody goes through my chemo treatment and keeps their hair. He said, I'd have to report you to the oncology board. He said, you're going to lose your hair, and you're going to get sick again. He said, but this is very encouraging. And he said, you know, heck, he said it might come back. He said, we might stop treatment. It might all come back. He said, or it might not. And I said, well, isn't this good? And he said, 5 years is a cure. But you know what? My sponsor and my mom and my dad and my wife, we did a little jig. Because, you know, when I know what the odds are, it's like, you know, usually those tumors respond partially or they don't respond at all. But he says, there's no sign of any of it anywhere. It's gone. And am I special? No. You know? And I was okay, I'll end with this. I'm talking to my sponsor, and I said, you know, I was so convinced I was going to die, and now it looks like I'm going to live, and I don't know how to handle either one. And he said, David, it's both self-centered either way you look at it. And I go, God dang. He goes, it's just the flip side. It's all about you. And I'm like, okay, you're right, you're right. And it is. It's self-centered. You know, I live, I die, you know, so. You know, confronting your own mortality, I went and made some quick amends. I imagine my old sponsor, Jim, up there in heaven saying, you better not show up until you've made it right with a few people. And so, you know, I'm trying to straighten things out. And you know, it's like when you're facing that, a lot of things just aren't important anymore. You know, they're just not important. But you know what is important is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what's important. This is what saved my life. You know what? I beat the disease of alcoholism, or God and I and the steps did. I've been sober 23 years. That's amazing. You know, cancer is nothing. Cancer is nothing compared to the disease of alcoholism. You know, when my sponsor Jim was dying and we went out to go see him, and he died of lung cancer, I went out to go see him. He picked up the book because people were calling the house saying, Jim, you don't know me, but I heard you were sick. You know, and I heard you talk in Little Rock in 1978, and your talks turned me around and saved my life. And I've always wanted to thank you, and I never have gotten to, and I heard you were sick, and I just wanted to call and say. And they installed a second phone line in the trailer out there where he was living because they couldn't make outgoing calls. There were so many incoming calls coming in and people wishing him well. And I was out there. It was the last time I got to see him while he was lucid. And I was out there to discuss things like who my new sponsor was going to be, because that's who he was, and, you know, how much time he had left and all this. And somebody said, what do you think about all these people calling? And he held up the book and he said, guys, he said, I am nothing special. He said, I have walked on the sunny side of the street for 29 years. I've had 29 years of good living I didn't deserve. He said, and all I did was I followed the instructions in the book. I am nobody special. I just followed the instructions. I stand on the shoulders of giants, men like Jim Shaw and these guys, you know, Jack Clater, Bob White, you know, and you know, the folks who are still living, my sponsor today, Gary Peek, you know, Johnny Harris, you know, all these guys. Man, you know, and I am so grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Before we begin participation, I'd like to thank our speaker, David M., for coming and speaking for us tonight. Tonight, how about we start Mitch?
Mitch! I'm Mitchell McCabe, alcoholic. I'm sober since July 1st, 99. For that, I'm truly grateful. Welcome, David. I got to hear you up in Norman a couple months ago. And that was a good story. Looking forward to hearing it. And guys from Wilmer, glad you're here. Actually, I've had a pretty good week, you know. But what really comes to my mind is this idea of sponsorship, you know, and about, you know, the things that were asked of me when I crawled in here defeated and asked my sponsor to sponsor me, and he asked me, was I willing to go to any lengths? And I said yes. And I have to remind myself constantly that, you know, I said that, but, you know, this deal of sponsorship, you know, it's a, you know, one of the great, you know, it's a, like a two-way street, I guess, you know. But the deal of, you know, if you're going, you know, if you're going to sponsor guys, I guess, you know, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, you better be doing, you know, what you're being asked to do, you know, and to give it away the way it was given to me, you know, and not water it down. And, you know, like, I guess, you know, I have three committed meetings a week, you know, and two of them are where my sponsor goes. And the other one, now I don't go with them anymore to that meeting. And so, you know, it's up to me to go there, you know, and I show up to that meeting. And I asked the guys that I'm, you know, I sponsored to show up to that meeting. And anyway, I'm just glad to be here. Thanks.
How about Ann?
Hi, my name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ann.
Sobriety at age January 23rd, 2002. And thank you, Dave, for coming to speak for us. I look forward to hearing. My week is by leaps and bounds much better than last week. Going through with our 11th step here with being the 11th month. I was going through the 12 and 12 with my sponsor last night, and it was such an aha moment for me. Or maybe it was the night before, but it was talking about having the conscious contact with God. And I've always been raised in a very religious family and prayer and church and all that. And it never really dawned on me what that conscious contact with God really was. I mean, I would pray and I would pray for, you know, whatever was best to come out. I didn't do the laundry list of Santa, gimme, gimme, gimmes, but I did do those prayers of, you know, whatever's best, may it work out. But it never really came to me about being the instrument of carrying out God's will and asking God for me to be of service to other people. And coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I carried this weight of shame and, you know, all the things that I had done and been and what a worthless human being I was. And I was just astounded to see my sponsor who had gone through similar things, and she wasn't so ashamed of herself. And I really admired that, and I really wanted that. And I had an opportunity this week to see how giving that away to somebody else was possible. And it just, I couldn't believe that I was a part of that. But it took for her to show me that, you know, because you're in the places that you are and you have the things to share that you do to the right person at the right time, and who's to say when that's going to be. I certainly wasn't planning on that, but it was a very fulfilling feeling, and it was really neat that here I am doing this prayer in this conscious contact with God and asking to be of service to other people and having it shown to me how it's coming to fruition. And it's because of this program that I'm able to actually participate in that kind of effect in other people's lives and actually be able to see that too. That's always nice. So glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's hear from Ariel.
This is my first time up here, so I'm. I'm Ariel. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ariel.
Okay, all I really know is that I've been drinking for about 12 years, and I ain't never had really any peace in my life. And I was like really tired of drinking and all that. So last year I made a decision to go to Cornell, and that's where I'm at right now. I don't really know anything, but you know, it's like I've been coming out here a few times. I've been coming out here, and you know, I feel Mike, you know, he's gonna sponsor me when I get out, and so I'm really looking forward to that because I've, you know. Okay, you know, cause get nervous. No, it's like I see him and he's always happy. So that's what I want. You know, I want to be happy. I want to be sober and happy. You know, not just sober. I want to be happy too. That's really all I got.
Oh, Danny.
Hi, I'm Danny Kroll, alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
And I've been sober since April 24th of 94. And David, thank you for coming to talk for us tonight. And welcome to all of our visitors. I guess I was thinking this week about this insurance form that I had to fill out yesterday. My wife and I are switching insurance. And so I had to fill out this questionnaire. And it asked all these questions about, you know, have you had a DUI in the last, you know, 3 years? And, you know, asks all about your health history, and you know, I was really reflecting on, you know, how nice it is to be able to say, no, I haven't, and you know, and really to pretty much have a clean slate on those things, and but you know, there was one question on there that said, you know, have you been to a treatment center or Alcoholics Anonymous or you know, been to a psych ward or something like that over the last 3 years, and you know, I guess I was, at the time, I was just thinking about, you know, being honest, and, you know, I always like when I talk to my doctors, I always let them know I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I put yes, I've, you know, been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 3 years, and, you know, it asked the reason why, and I put alcoholism, and, you know, and it asked for the results, and I was able to, you know, put that, you know, I've remained sober since 1994, and, anyway, I was talking to Mike about that this morning, and he said, well, you know, that might not have been the best way to handle that. Maybe that was one you should have left blank. And, you know, I really got to thinking about that. And that's, you know, really, it's not the insurance company's business if I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I don't know, I'll talk to Mike about that more, but I'm thinking about filing a complaint with them. anyway, you know, we had dinner tonight at Pizza Villa before we came over here. And this word came up that I'd always heard, and I thought it was kind of a neat word, but I never really knew what it meant until a few months ago, and the word is nihilist. And what that word means, it's someone that has lost their belief in anything moral in life and in the difference between what right and wrong. And, you know, I really didn't know what was wrong with me when I first got to you people, but, you know, I could certainly describe myself as a nihilist, and I had, you know, kind of lost all hope, and I thought that life was, you know, just kind of a cruel joke, and I was the punchline, and you know, if God was up there somewhere, he didn't care about me. And, you know, I'm happy to say that after, you know, getting active in Alcoholics Anonymous and taking the steps and, you know, learning how to trust in God and, you know, taking an inventory of my deep, dark secrets and, you know, cleaning those up and, you know, setting right the harms I've caused others and, you know, doing those things, that I don't feel that way anymore today. I have, you know, I have hope and I have a sense of purpose in my life. And, you know, I'm able to surrendered to sponsor direction, and I'm able to be of service and help others. And, you know, it's really a good deal, and I'm glad to be here tonight.
Chrisam.
Chrisam!
I'm Chris McGinnis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris!
I've been sober since January 25th of 91. And David, it's good to have you here tonight. I'm looking forward to your talk. And welcome to any visitors. This week has been, well, the last few weeks have been pretty busy for me. And it was starting a new job and all the changes. What's one thing about life? I was listening to a tape and it was talking about how we're constantly in motion and life's always in motion, and I don't like changes, and I've been through a lot of changes lately, and I'm grateful for the, you know, when I was first in AA, I used to say the slogans and, you know, easy does it and all this, and really not, no, I was trying to fit in, but the one day at a time thing has really come in handy of just putting one foot in front of the other and showing up. And so far, I've showed up everywhere. And Tuesday, I spent all day in training on a job in another town. And I was with someone who is very bitter and unhappy right now because they really basically are losing their job after 20-something years. And I was in a difficult situation. I'm training on their job. And I was with her all day long, and it was very, very negative. And I was so irritated at myself because I reacted. I let it get to me. And, you know, at 5 o'clock, I let it get to me. And, you know, and I had to, and I went to a meeting that night, and it was good to go visit other groups and be at a meeting that night. And, you know, when you walk into a meeting, nowhere, no matter where I'm at, it was just that relief, you know, I'm with my own kind. And I sat down in that meeting and, you know, and got through that resentment that night. And the next day I made amends to the lady, and we had a pretty good day together. And strange as it may seem, that when we were at lunch, we didn't talk about work. And, you know, and actually she's a pretty nice person. But, you know, there's been a lot of things going on. My 21-year-old niece does alcohol and drugs, and she's in prison. She's in jail right now on her way to prison. And my other nephew is in a treatment center for the second time, so he's doing the rounds. And so at least he's been introduced, and his drinking is ruined. So we'll see what happens with them. My sister's, they're both my sister's kids, don't want me to. They want me to listen. They don't want to hear what I have to say. So I don't say anything. I just listen. And let them run whatever course they have to run. And that's hard. But I do. And so it's really good to be here tonight. Thanks.
Mike.
Thanks, Larry. Mike Erickson, alcoholic. Hi, everybody. July 19th of 87 is my sobriety date. And, Dave, I'm glad you're here. It's good to see you after, I think we narrowed it down to 8 or 7 years since we've seen each other. We have a history, and I'm glad our history has been put back together tonight, because sometimes years go by without seeing each other in this deal. And it's unfortunate, because sometimes we build good relationships, and for one reason or another, they're torn asunder, you know, and I'm glad that God is who he says he is, and that he brings us back together and makes things right. You know, I had to do kind of like you're talking about. I'm an alcoholic, drinking or not drinking. I'm an alcoholic, and I carry the same defects of character with me today that I walked into this door with. I carry the same sufferings of selfishness and self-centeredness and self-seeking and self-serving and self-delusion and self-pity. I'm a judgmental bastard, and you know, I'm dishonest and resentful and angry, and this happens frequently. 16 years of attending your program, this happens frequently. And last Tuesday I was at a meeting that didn't do it like we do it here. And by God, I had to let them know it. And I did. And I opened up a can of Mike Erickson all over them. And that's not a pretty thing. Nobody deserves that. Nobody deserves that. And see, what I looked at is this idea that I had a chance to be helpful to these people, and I destroyed that chance by being a jackass. And so I had to go into that meeting, and I had to make amends to those people. I had to go back to that meeting and tell them I was a jackass. If there's anything I can do to make it right, you please let me know, and that's what I'll do. That's what I'll try and do. And, you know, I'll tell you what, I do not like living. See, I lived my life like that for years, and I would drink on top of that. And I think the drinking would make it go away for a little while, but I woke up and that when I'd come to the other side of a drunk, that pain would be more intense than the day before. The book talks about our problems piling up on us and becoming astonishingly difficult to solve. And I do nothing but compound them because I take a drink and I take a drink and I take another drink and go through the same stuff over again and compound it and compound it, and nothing ever gets solved. And today I don't live with, I don't seem to live with those dilemmas or those problems near to the degree that I lived with them when I was drinking. And that's the promise and the hope that goes with me today, is that alcoholism never leaves me. But what these 12 steps do in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous does is it gives me a way to walk through those with some grace and dignity, which is something I had never been able to do before. And interesting thing is, Danny, it's funny, what Danny told you tonight from the podium, it's not to pick on Danny, but what Danny told you is not what I heard myself say. This is an interesting thing about perception, right? And the question I asked myself was, gosh, I wonder if having those guys have a question of are you alcoholic on that form, is that a violation of our tradition? Is that breaching our affiliation? It was kind of an interesting question on whether or not that would. And I was like, I wonder, I got to go take a look at that and see how I would respond in the case that someone asked me that question. How would I respond? And then the thought comes to my mind. My sponsor says to me, being honest never makes you look bad. So these two dichotomies of thought. And the nice thing about being in this pro and con mode is I got to go search. And those little things make me search and seek. And seek God's will and something that I can live comfortably with. And I'm glad to be here with you tonight. Thanks.
Chris H.
Chris Hatfield, an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Sobriety date's February 10th, 2003. And for that, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. I was talking to Ariel earlier, and he was talking about the word grateful. One of the best descriptions of the word grateful is when that policeman's behind you and you're drunk and Cooter Brown, and he finally turns off. that was grateful. My day in my life today is exceptionally good. It really is. I can tell by the way, whenever I get up in the morning, if I get on my knees immediately and I ask God to come into this day with me, how everything just turns out great. And how every once in a while you gotta go slide off in the bathroom and make sure he's still here. You're still here. Get down here. And that's when the day usually goes its best. And then whenever your step 10 flies in there real quick and somebody disturbs you and like Mike had to do last night. I think that's good about sponsorship. You get to go with your sponsor to meetings. You get to hang around with them. You get to see them do the program, like whenever they act like an ass. They teach you how to make an amends. And for that, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. I was listening to a tape last night, and I remember David A. telling me to my face one day, screaming it in my face, all this program is, it's a spiritual program, it's going to teach you how not to drink, it's going to teach you, it's going to get you ready for death, it's going to get you ready to die. And then he'd turn around and he'd say, with a clean slate, if you do it right. I've had the privilege of having my dad in town He's not close enough to see her or not, but I get to call him every morning, every day, and every day at lunch, and two or three times during the day. And I've made all the amends I can to these people that I've harmed. I think an alcoholic's guilt and shame is one of the dangerous things we have. And that's when the ego deflation steps up and you're going to do anything to keep your ego as big as you can. That's my behavior as an alcoholic. I thought today I'd take off work, go spend a little time with him, and then I remember what my sponsor said. He said, you go to the work, you do 110% for this guy. And one of the things I've heard here lately is whenever you're working for someone, would you fire the guy if he was you? If your behavior, if he were you and his behavior, or is he doing the most he can for you? And that's what I try to do in my workplace today. I get caught up. I go help the other guy. It's not natural for me to do something like that. It's not normal. It's something I've been taught. I have the opportunity of going in the morning and pulling the cover up over my wife and snuggling her in and kissing her and asking her if she wants to pray with me. And a lot of mornings she's real sick from what she's got. But just to go in there to hold her hand and just to let her know, I'm very grateful.
Steve.
Hi, my name is Steve Dine, and I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date, August 24, 2001. Thanks, David, for coming out and speaking for us, and welcome to all our visitors. I've had a good week. You know, it's one of just a fun-filled week of a lot of AA stuff. On Saturday, we went to Baylor. On Sunday, I went out to Wilmer and worked with some guys. Monday, we had our regular home group meeting. Tuesday, went out to Wilmer and got to do the steps, and I can guarantee that's not something I thought I could ever do. And then Wednesday, there wasn't much going on, you know, and it just had got some extra sleep and watching movies and stuff, you know. And this morning in my call to sponsor kind of was a little lame, as kind of normal, I guess. But, you know, I know better than to complain to my sponsor. I mean, I know. And I bring up this idea, you know, my tooth hurts from dental work I had done, you know. And I got kind of an earful. Well, first, why don't you go to the dentist? And I'm like, well, he's the one that screwed it up, you know. But... you know, it just made me think, you know, how Wednesday night, nothing's going on. So it kind of reflects my Thursday morning call. You know, all of a sudden now I'm complaining about how I feel, you know, and how I have some pain. And you know, of course, my sponsor doesn't have much sympathy for that kind of, you know, for whiners, you know. And I guess that's better left for my wife. She does a real good job with that, you know. She hey, chicken noodle soup, you know, and, you know, I get some kind of sympathy sometimes, but anyway, it's been a great week, and it's a lot better than before I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's just no comparison. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, why I wouldn't ever have done these steps to begin with, you know, and how, why I fought them so hard. Thanks for letting me share.